It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Tony Mikos. Tony and I have known each other for a long, long time. We've been colleagues at Rice University, where I was now also a while ago. Tony came a little earlier than I did with a PhD from Purdue, and I guess postdoc at MIT and at Harvard, and has been at Rice ever since. Been incredibly successful at Rice. I won't mention his age index, not to shame the other people in the room, but it's in the three digits. It's pretty phenomenal. And he's also received many awards, National Academy of Engineering, amongst others. So during the time that Tony was at Rice, and that we were both at Rice, actually, Rice went through a similar transformation than the one that we recently went through. We created what is called bioengineering department here. It's called biomedical school here. There it was created largely out of the chemical engineering school, but many of the experiences, I think, were the same. And I think when we before we actually created the school, a couple of phone calls to with Tony to know what to do and especially what not to do in the process of that. So, without further ado, it's a great pleasure to have you on campus, and I'd like to ask that you join me in welcoming Tony to our campus. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor for me to be here to visit the University of Sydney. And I would like to thank Dean Zanepol and Head Schwanning and the rest of the Faculty of Engineering for this honor. I've been at Rice my entire professional career. I had the opportunity to work with great colleagues, great students, and I owe everything that I have accomplished to my students and my collaborators. And what I would like to share with you today is some of the highlights of our recent work in the development of biomaterials for tissue engineering and also for tumor modeling. So tissue engineering is a relatively young field. The term tissue engineering was defined in the beginning of my academic career as the application of principles of engineering in life sciences and medical sciences towards the development of biological substitutes to enhance, maintain, or replace tissue function. Tissue function that is lost because of tumor, trauma, or abnormal development. In the 90s and the early 2000s, everybody was talking about the great potential of tissue engineering to revolutionize medicine. The promise of tissue engineering in 2019, tissue engineering is no longer in the United States and many places around the world, is no longer an academic exercise. There are products that are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration and patients benefit from these products. So in the beginning of the year, we reported in the journal Tissue Engineering a survey of the tissue engineering market. We focus in the last 7 years, and we survey all the publicly traded companies that in the United States have to submit progress and financial reports in the Securities and Exchange Commission, and also based on clinical trial data that are available in the National Library of Medicine through clinicaltrials.gov. So this is the results of that survey. So we have the survey of the tissue, the sales of the tissue engineering products in 2017 compared to the total company sales. The tissue engineering products were classified into three broad categories as biomaterials products. This includes both synthetic and natural biomaterials, and also a combination of biomaterials with bioactive molecules such as growth factors. The second category was cell and biomaterials, that is different combinations of cells with biomaterials. And the third category was that of stem cells. As you can see from this diagram to the right-hand side, is that the sales in 2017 were about $9 billion. So there is a significant market that is growing, but 99% of the total sales from tissue engineering products were biomaterials-based products. So clearly, biomaterials play a very important role in tissue engineering. Biomaterials have been investigated over the years as scaffolds to direct tissue growth and also for transplantation of cells. Clearly, when the clinical trials were analyzed, I mean, a significant number of clinical trials from 2011 to 2018. Interestingly, out of the total clinical trials, about half of them were biomaterials based products. However, there is a lot of activity with the development of products based on a combination of cells with biomaterials and also stem cells. So 5 years from now, when I hope that I will have the opportunity to visit Sydney, I should be able to report to you that there are more products based on stem cells, because clearly the data suggests that there is a lot of activity, I mean, in the stem cell community, and we will all benefit from the advances in stem cell biology. So the clinical trials were phase one clinical trials, two, three, and four. And as one would have expected, that these clinical trials were funded mostly from industry. There is a lot of activity, I mean, in tissue engineering industry that includes both startups and established companies, but also government plays a very important role in supporting clinical trials in tissue engineering products. Our work over the years has focused on the musculoskeletal system to develop biomaterials that can be used mainly in the beginning for bone tissue engineering, and then the last 10 years in cartilage and muscle tissue engineering. So the musculoskeletal system has been of great interest to us. And earlier this year, we reported in the journal Biomaterials a review article that essentially summarizes not only our efforts, but the efforts of the entire community, how the investigators are using the structure of bone, the structure at the nano, micro, and macro level, from the organization of collagen fibrils all the way to the trabecular structure, as an inspiration for the development of materials, materials that incorporate biologically important signaling molecules, materials that incorporate ceramic components. And I must say that this review was a collaborative effort with colleagues at Huazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan, China, in collaboration with Dr. Sengming Zhang and his colleagues, whose expertise is mainly in ceramic materials. So clearly, the anatomy and the physiology of any tissue has provided inspiration to all of us, biomaterial scientists, in developing new structures, nanostructures, microstructures that mimic the structure of natural bone to develop strategies for the regeneration of bone. One such strategy was reported this year in Science Advances by our laboratory. Essentially, it's a strategy that combines advances in synthetic chemistry with advances in biology. Knowing the role that peptides and protein fragments play, and also glycosaminoglycans play in the regeneration of the tissue, we design cross linkers for the fabrication of hydrogels that incorporate these biological cues. For example, we developed chemistries that include sulfhydryl groups at the end that will allow covalent cross linking. They include alkene amines that can be reacting with Klim chemistry, with azides that have been modified to incorporate glycosaminoglycans, hydrophobic, hydrophilic peptide as needed for a particular application. The beauty of this chemistry is that it's done at room temperature, at ambient conditions, so there is no risk for denaturing any bioactive molecules, and also the catalysts that are involved are cytocompatible catalysts. So here you can see how these particular cross-linkers can react with other polymers. One particular class of polymers that is of great interest to us are thermoresponsive polymers. So the polymers that can undergo a phase transition when the temperature changes from 25 degrees to 37 degrees. These are polymers that can be in solution in liquid form at room temperature, but can gel at 37 degrees. And these polymers are characterized by low critical solution temperature between 25 and 37. So having such a polymer as that shown in the top left corner that incorporates anisopropyl acrylamide and also a glycine methacrylate that includes an epoxy group. The epoxy group can react with the sulfur hydryl, and we can have this cross-linked network that incorporate this functional, the tissue-specific biomolecules within the structure. Now, the thermal polymers that undergo thermal gelations have been very popular in pharmacy. One of the reasons that they have not been used so much in tissue engineering because these polymers undergo constant synergesis. So their volume constantly decreases, they expel wort, and any cells that are incorporated within the structure eventually starve because they don't cannot get the necessary nutrients. One way to address this problem is to polymerize, to cross-link these polymers not only by thermal gelations, but also by chemical gelation. So essentially, these cross-links that we incorporate within the structure not only introduce the functional motifs to any encapsulated cells, but also prevent the synergesis of the chains to prevent the collapse of the network. So recently, we reported in JBMR a study where we modify this, we introduce into those cross-linkers different bioactive molecules. Specifically, we introduced carbohydrates as well as selecting and selecting peptides and also bone homing peptides and other osteogenic peptides. The goal was to introduce molecules that will drive chondrogenesis and osteogenesis. One of our goals is to engineer osteochondral defects in the knee. That is complex anisotropic defects that consists essentially of two layers, like a cartilage layer, articular cartilage layer, and a subchondral bone. So the goal will be to use formulations that will drive osteogenesis at the subchondral tissue and also chondrogenesis at the surface. So by incorporating chondroitin sulfate and also N-selectin, we're able to drive chondrogenesis in a dose-specific manner, and also by incorporating bone-homing peptides, we're able to induce calcification and mineralization of the construct that is very important for the formation of a bone tissue. Another chemistry that we also reported this year involves the use of chondroitin sulfate as a cross-linker. So in this particular case, we modify chondroitin sulfate and we introduce the functional groups that can be used to cross-link with synthetic macromers, but very importantly, by incorporating chondroitin sulfate as a cross-linker, we're able to introduce the functional moieties that will facilitate the adhesion of the hydrogel with the surrounding cartilage tissue, which is one of the big challenges with the development of materials for cartilage tissue engineering. So we can encapsulate cells, but also we can facilitate the integration of the construct after implantation into an animal model and eventually in humans with the surrounding tissue and to address this problem. The beauty of these materials is that they can be introduced into the body with minimal surgical intervention in a form of injectable formulations. That is, formulations that can be injected in a liquid form. Once the temperature changes, they transition into a solid state essentially immediately, and the cross-linking reaction that happens gradually facilitates, prevents the synergesis and facilitates the integration of the hydrogel with the surrounding tissue. However, there is a great need not only for injectable materials, but also for shape-specific implants that will address anatomical areas in the body, especially bones. For this reason, we have been using 3D printing technologies and bioprinting, specifically multi-material printing, to build constructs with different composition, different mechanical properties, different architectures, again, in an effort to modulate the differentiation of stem cells and create the anisotropy in the properties of the tissue, in the cellular phenotype and also in the extracellular matrix composition that is very important for the regeneration of tissue. So we have been very fortunate, and we have been awarded a big center grant from the National Institutes of Health to start a center for engineering complex tissues in collaboration with colleagues at the University of Maryland and the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And some of the work that I share with you is part of this collaborative effort at RISE that focuses on the development of multi-material 3D printing technologies. So we were able to print scaffolds with different printing technologies, and one of them is extrusion printing. Essentially, we can print fibers of biodegradable polymers, such as polyepsilon caprolactone, polylactic glycolic acids, and composites of these polymers together with microparticles and nanoparticles of calcium phosphates, specifically hydroxyapatite and beta tricalcium phosphates. So what you can see here in these images that were acquired using microcomputed tomography is that we can have different gradients in the pore size and the porosity. We can have gradients in the amount of hydroxyapatite that we can incorporate within the scaffolds, and we can also have dual gradients, I mean, of both pore architecture and also composition. One of the nice things that we found was that the mechanical properties of these constructs is dictated more by the porosity, and it is independent from the pore size. Actually, this is something that is predicted by theoretical calculations of cellular materials. So we have established very important power laws that dictate how the compressive strength and the compressive modulus depend on the porosity of the materials. So also, this year we reported in a study where we took these materials with the different gradients, and we seeded the mesenchymal stem cells that we isolated from the marrow of a rabbit model. So essentially, we create different gradients and of porosity and composition, as well as control materials with uniform composition and uniform porosity. And we seeded them with the stem cells, and this is confocal micrographs at day one. What appears as green on the screen stands for actin. This is the cell. What you see here at the center, this is the cross-section of the fiber. And what appears as with an asterisk, this is the porosity. This is the pores. So essentially, the mesenchymal stem cells coat the surface of the scaffold. And again, the goal is to see how these gradients in the architecture and the composition can affect the differentiation of the cells. Indeed, what we found was that for mesenchymal stem cells that differentiate along the osteogenic lineage, that is, they're becoming bone-forming cells or osteoblasts, the compositional gradient affects their differentiation. So in the presence of beta-tricalcium phosphates, they differentiate faster and in an enhanced way to bone-forming cells. Now, those of you who may not be familiar with calcium phosphate materials, hydroxyapatite is a material that degrades very, very, very slowly. Beta-tricalcium phosphate is a material that degrades very fast, it dissolves very fast, and it's a material that, because of the release of calcium cations and phosphate anions, they can really have an effect on the differentiation of stem cells. So clearly, the chemical environment affects the differentiation of the cells. What we also find is the porosity affects the differentiation of the cells. Essentially, topographical constraints, the affinity of cells to interact with each other, also affect the differentiation. So clearly, what we found from this study is that these gradients in architecture and composition allow us to develop constructs, cell-laden scaffolds with a gradient in the phenotype of the mesenchymal stem cells, which is very important for the engineering of complex anisotropic tissues, not only articular cartilage, but other orthopedic interfaces in tendons and ligaments, where we have a gradient of mineralization. Vertical gradients are very important. However, horizontal gradients are equally important. What you see in these slides, we're able to combine 3D printing with the welding of individual fibers. So we can print in a horizontal way fiber segments, and we can weld those particular segments so that we can have a horizontal gradient. That will be very important, for example, when we're interested in the engineering of long bones, and there is a gradient in the composition and the architecture of the bone. And here we can incorporate different calcium phosphate materials with different dissolution kinetics, again in an effort to drive the differentiation of any stem cells and form a tissue with the desired mechanical properties. So in terms of 3D printing, I mean, we have developed technologies that allow us reproducibly to fabricate scaffolds with control architecture and control composition, and this is a very important requirement for the translation of these scaffolds into the clinic, that is their reproducibility. Also, by engineering, by combining 3D printing with traditional ceramic processing techniques such as sintering, we can fabricate constructs out of composites of polymer with microparticles or nanoparticles of calcium phosphates. We can burn essentially the polymer by raising the temperature to over 1000 degrees Celsius. No polymer is stable at temperatures above 300 degrees, so the polymer bursts, and what is left behind is the calcium phosphate that at certain temperature we have sintering of the particles, and we can form eventually scaffolds that are prepared out of an extrusion process that are made 100% of the calcium phosphates. Now, most of the extrusion techniques involving synthetic polymers operate at higher temperature, because these are the temperatures that are needed to for the polymer to be in a liquid form or a melt form, so that can be extruded and form the different shapes. What presents a huge challenge is how to incorporate growth factor within these polymers, because growth factors are very sensitive. So one cannot incorporate the growth factors within a mixture of a polymer that will be heated to 100 or 120 degrees, because the growth factors will be deactivated. For this reason, we develop an engraving technique. Essentially, we can 3D print the construct without any growth factor. And as we 3D print, then that follows with an engraving process that essentially will create a groove within its fiber. And again, the fiber has a diameter of a few hundred micrometers. So following the printing, we create a groove of controlled depth. And inside that groove, we can deposit microparticles with growth factors. We can deposit cells. We can deposit any other bioactive material, essentially at room temperature. And that allows us to fabricate constructs that not only have control architecture and control mechanical properties, but we can introduce control phenotypes at different locations within the scaffolds, or we can incorporate different bioactive molecules and different concentration of these bioactive molecules, so we can have a spatiotemporal presentation of these bioactive molecules to cells. Now, the architecture of the scaffolds and the composition of the scaffolds is very important. One of the reasons that it's very important is because if one is able to regenerate tissues without the use of any biologics, without the use of any growth factors, or without the use of any stem cells, that can accelerate significantly the regulatory process. I'm a big believer of the role of stem cells and the growth factors. However, I'm a very pragmatic person, and realize that their presence can delay the regulatory process. So the message that I always try to communicate to colleagues and students is that we should always try a biomaterials first, and if a biomaterials fails, then we can incorporate stem cells or bioactive molecules. So in a study that we reported 2 years ago in collaboration with Dr. Sengming Zhang from Huazhong University of Science and Technology, is that we investigated how different architectures of materials that are made of microparticles that include calcium phosphate, that are sintered, laser sintered, can be used to regenerate articular cartilage without any stem cells and without any growth factors. And we were very successful because we were able to fabricate materials that incorporated different amounts of calcium phosphates at different layers, at different heights, in an effort to create a gradient in the mechanical properties. So starting with very weak mechanical properties to very strong mechanical properties, that will be the same gradient in mechanical properties that one finds in an osteochondral defect. And by this gradient in the mechanical properties and also in the composition of the particles, we're able to regenerate articular cartilage in a rabbit model. Again, this is, I'm not saying that biomaterials by themselves can regenerate any tissues, but we have the ability now to synthesize materials and fabricate materials with complex architectures that can regenerate especially musculoskeletal tissues. May not be the case for neurological tissues, but for musculoskeletal tissues, we and others have had many successes. Another area is the result of my collaboration with colleagues at Tsinghua University in Beijing and China, where we investigate how composites of mineralized collagen can be used to regenerate bone tissue. So this is mineralized collagen. It has the high affinity for homing of bioactive molecules in vivo and has been investigated for many different tissue engineering applications. In this particular case, in cranioplasty, we fabricate materials that incorporate mineralized collagen. And in a SIP model, in a large cranial defect, we see how the mineralized collagen can be integrated with the surrounding tissue because it can be remodeled. So it allows for migration of stem cells from the surrounding tissue and also the degradation and remodeling of the mineralized collagen. That's not the case for polymethyl methacrylate in titanium, where one clearly sees the interface with the surrounding bone that is very prone to infection. So this is another case where biomaterials themselves, without any biologics, can be used for the regeneration of tissues. If there is one class of biomaterials that's becoming very popular in recent years, at least in the United States, that is the decellularized extracellular matrix. The reason being is that there have been many technologies developed that allow us to successfully decellularize tissue, to harvest the extracellular matrix, and at the same time remove the DNA from the tissue that can elicit an immune response. So recently, we reported the decellularization of skeletal muscle. Now, decellularization of skeletal muscle is something that many investigators have reported before. What was new in this particular case is that we did not use any harsh surfactants that tend to remove all the DNA, but at the same time remove many of the therapeutic proteins. So we use mild enzymes to remove the DNA while keeping most of the proteins present in the tissue that have a therapeutic effect. So you can see here how, from the decellularization, one can remove the DNA, and one then relying on the polyelectrolyte nature of the extracellular matrix and the electrostatic interactions, one can use electrospinning to fabricate extracellular matrix fibers without the use of any filler polymer. So what is the novelty of the work is that we can fabricate materials that include most of the extracellular matrix proteins, but very importantly, all the intracellular matrix proteins. So we not only keep the extracellular matrix, but in the case of skeletal muscle, myosin and actin, which are intracellular proteins, which are very important with therapeutic effect, can be retained. And the only extracellular proteins for skeletal muscle is about 1.3%. So this is a very small number, so the yield is very high because we can recover most of the proteins that are needed as part of a regenerative strategy. So I'm going to shift gears now and focus on efforts in our laboratory the past 10 years within the Armed Forces Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Under the leadership of Tony Atala, myself, and many other colleagues at 40 universities in the United States and abroad have been involved in efforts to develop technologies that will be translated into the clinic. The Department of Defense has been the main supporter of this effort and many other federal agencies. The goal of AFFIRM was not to produce great science. The goal of AFFIRM was not to produce papers that were published in Science or Nature. The goal of AFFIRM was to translate technologies into the clinic within a 5-year period. For this reason, we had to think about the regulatory process. We needed to engage clinicians and business people that will be responsible for the commercialization efforts. And I was very fortunate to be in charge of the craniomaxillofacial program in collaboration with Dr. Mark Wong of the University of Texas Health Science Center. Now, the challenge that we faced was that first, the defects in soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are not defects in bone, cartilage, muscle, vascular tissue, or nerve, but all of the above. These are composite tissue defects, so they involve more than one tissue. And many times, the integration of individual strategies that work great for individual tissues do not work well for composite tissues. So the second challenge that we face was that those defects following INDs or other explosive devices are highly contaminated. So we had to investigate the interplay of infection and regeneration and how infected defects can be regenerated. So for the past 10 years, we have been working on a strategy that essentially involves the use of different biomaterials. So a defect in the mandible, our vision at that time that was published in 2012 was to introduce a space maintainer in the place of a mandible. The space maintainer will be an inert material that essentially maintains the volume that eventually will be occupied by bone tissue, facilitates the healing of the soft tissue, preserves the area and prevents the formation of any scar tissue that would have been filled in the absence of any space maintainer, and at the same time provides a carrier for the controlled release of antibiotics. Now, as the soft tissue matures and heals, we envision the use of a bioreactor in vivo that is growing bone ectopically at another site in the body. So the space maintainer will be temporary, would be removed, and then the volume that was occupied with the space maintainer would be now occupied with a bone tissue that can be grown in another site in the body, like on the rib, and then eventually will be transferred into the mandible. So eventually the patient will have both the soft tissue regenerated, the hard tissue regenerated without any scar tissue. So the past 10 years, we've made significant progress. For 3 years, we investigated the physicochemical properties of these space maintainers. We had to take into consideration the regulatory process. So our laboratory can synthesize essentially any material with any properties. I mean, that's the strength of our laboratory, is polymer chemistry and polymer fabrication. However, any material, any new material that we design, it may take 20 or 30 years to be regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. So the big decision we had to make is to use materials that are currently regulated by the Food and Drug Administration and try to use combination of these materials as part of the strategy. Now, I don't want to communicate the message in the young students in the audience that by taking one device that is regulated and combine it with another device that is being regulated, the combination is automatically regulated. It's not regulated, but because of the regulatory history, the regulatory process can be expedited. So what we used was porous polymethyl methacrylate. Methyl methacrylate, it's a material that is used extensively in orthopedic surgery and dentistry in the form of a bone cement. So essentially, a mixture of the methyl methacrylate together with an initiator is injected into a defect, can solidify it, and can be as hard, I mean, as a bone. And this trade name for polymethyl methacrylate that many of you may have heard is plexiglass. It's transparent and it's a very strong material. So the hypothesis of our work was that porous polymethyl methacrylate can induce differentiation and maturation of the soft tissue, and also porous polymethyl methacrylate can facilitate the release of any bioactive molecules that are incorporated within the structure. And also polymethyl methacrylate that is porous can anchor with the surrounding soft tissue to prevent any dehiscence. So for the creation of the porous polymethyl methacrylate, we mixed the monomer together with carboxymethacellulose. Carboxymethacellulose is another material that is part of orthopedic devices that is regulated. So we had materials that are part of medical devices that were regulated. Some of the first studies involved this animal model. This is a 10 millimeter circular defect, it's a bicortical defect in the mandible of the rabbit with a 2 to 3 millimeter superior notch that creates a soft tissue defect and allows the communication of this defect with the oral cavity. So it's essentially a natural contaminated defect. When we use in rabbit studies, we tested porous polymethyl methacrylates. You can appreciate the healing of the oral mucosa in the case of porous PMMA. In the case of solid PMMA, we have dehiscence and eventually extrusion of the biomaterials. So after a series of preclinical studies, we proceeded into clinical cases under the direction of Dr. Wong at the University of Texas Health Science Center. The next three slides are graphics. So if you want to close your eyes, you can close your eyes and I'll tell you where to open them. So these are the first clinical cases that involve cancer patients. Cancer patients that had ameliobластoma. Ameliobластoma is a benign tumor in the mandible that needs to be removed. So the reason that we selected cancer patients for the first clinical cases is because after the removal of a tumor, the boundaries are clean, they are not contaminated, so there is no infection. And also, after the tumor is removed, the boundaries are well defined. So we can use, the cancer patients initially. And here you can see the first cases after the removal of the tumor, the space maintainer is fabricated in the lab. There is a place that is used to fix the space maintainer in the mandible. This is the microcomputed tomography image of the space maintainer. What appears as black is the material. What appears as black is the porous, is the porosity. So we're not talking about a material that is 90% porous. It's about 15 to 20% porosity. It essentially provides a surface roughness to interlock with the surrounding tissue and also have some channels to allow for the release of bioactive molecules. And what you see at the top is how the soft tissue can mature. This is a historic control. We were not the first one who thought about space maintainers. Polymethyl methacrylate has been used in the past in a non-porous form, and this is the results. We have dehiscence and extrusion of the biomaterial that needs to be removed. So although the first cases were done with material that is fabricated into the OR, next we took advantage of all the advances in 3D printing. So essentially, from CT scans of the mandible of patients, we can build plastic models. What you see up in the left is the plastic model. The surgeon can identify where the ameliobластoma is, can mark the piece of the tissue that is removed. This piece of the model can be removed and can be used to fabricate out of a silicone polymer a negative template inside which the space maintainer is produced. So the space maintainer is this material. The reason that it appears blue is because barium sulfate is incorporated, so one can image the space maintainer. This is the piece of the tissue of the mandible that is removed with the ameliobластoma. Then the space maintainer can be implanted inside the defect. The soft tissue is stretched, and 2 months later, the space maintainer can be removed. The soft tissue has been matured significantly, and then the surgeon can use a regenerative medicine approach that incorporates marrow, that can incorporate osteogenic molecules such as bone morphogenetic protein to regenerate the bone tissue. And eventually, we have the formation of a very healthy mandible without any synthetic material, a mandible that was for taking advances in materials fabrication and the properties of these materials, again, in the absence of any bioactive molecules. Of course, this was a clinical success, but it was a clinical success in an easy case where we didn't have any infection. So to address the case of infection, we're incorporating within the space maintainers carriers for antibiotics. So the carriers that we selected will be microparticles that would be loaded with different antibiotics. And each microparticle will be loaded with a specific antibiotic. So if we like to target different microbial populations, we can mix microparticles that are loaded with the different antibiotics. And this will be as part of the space maintainer and will be slowly released as the PLGA microparticles degrade and the antibiotic is released to the surrounding medium through the channels inside the space maintainer. So we developed technology that we reported in the literature 5 years ago that allow us to fabricate microparticles loaded with different antibiotics. And what was most exciting about this particular work is that we developed methods to predict the release kinetics of the different antibiotics. So this is the microparticles loaded with different antibiotics that are shown at the top, from colistin to vancomycin to doxycycline. So for any new antibiotic, if we know the size of the antibiotic, if we know the charge of the antibiotic, if we know the solubility of the antibiotic, essentially the physicochemical properties of the antibiotic, we can predict the release kinetics of the antibiotics, and that would be very important for the performance of the space maintainer. Now, treating infection is not decoupled from the regeneration of the tissue. So we investigated extensively the interplay between regeneration and infection. And one study that we reported in the literature 3 years ago, we investigated how the release kinetics and the dose of antibiotic can affect the clearance of infection and also the regeneration of the soft tissue and the hard tissue. So we tested the same defect that I mentioned earlier, the bicortical defect in the mandible of the rabbit. We created that defect, and then before we introduced the space maintainer that was loaded with antibiotics, we inoculated bacteria. So we created an infection there, and then we placed the space maintainer together with the antibiotic, and we investigated how a burst versus sustained release and how low versus high dose can affect the clearance of the infection and also the regeneration of the tissue. Now, for the parameters that we investigated, we found that we can clear the infection in all the cases. However, what we found was that the release kinetics and the dose of the antibiotic can affect the quality of the regenerated tissue. So it can affect the antibiotics, can affect the bone tissue that is regenerated, they can affect the soft tissue that is regenerated. So one has to consider this interplay or the role that antibiotics can have in the regeneration of a tissue. So this year, we reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the combination of the space maintenance technology and the in vivo bioreactor technology in a large animal model in a sheep. So what we did essentially for the space maintenance is that we created a defect in the mandible of the sheep. And then after we created the defect in week zero, we implanted a space maintainer to fill that particular defect. So that was done at week zero. At the same time, we fabricated bioreactors. Bioreactors are essentially chambers that have all the faces closed, except for one that is placed against the periosteum of the rib of a sheep. Why periosteum? Periosteum is a very thin membrane. It's highly vascularized. There's a high concentration of progenitor cells, which in the right environment, they can migrate and form a bone tissue. So we used 3D printing, and we printed bioreactors of different shapes, of dimensions of 2 cm by 1 cm by 1 cm. So we're not talking about micrometers or millimeters, but rather centimeters, which will be dimensions of clinical relevance. And we fill these bioreactors with different materials. We tested 2 materials. The first was morselized corticocancellous bone graft. So we took bone graft from the same animal, we morselized it, and we filled the particles inside the bioreactor. And the second was a calcium phosphate, a biphasic calcium phosphate. Now, the hypothesis behind the autologous graft was that any cells that were present in the bone that was morselized died. They didn't survive the process. However, what was left behind was the extracellular matrix, which was very rich in signaling molecules that would be slowly released to induce bone formation. Biphasic ceramics are made of combinations of hydroxyapatite and beta-dricalcium phosphate. So hydroxyapatite does dissolves very, very slowly, so it will be there essentially forever and provide a scaffold to guide bone formation. However, beta-tricalcium phosphate will dissolve very fast to release calcium and phosphate ions that will induce the differentiation of stem cells. So they implanted for 9 weeks. At 9 weeks, the space maintainer was removed. Then the bone that was generated inside the bioreactor was harvested and was transferred into the defect, the place of the space maintainer, and it was transferred as a flap. Tissues can be transferred as grafts or flaps. Graft is when you take a piece of the tissue and you transfer it as is. Flap is when you take the tissue together with the vascular network and microsurgically anastomose the tissue to the neighboring vasculature, so you restore flow immediately. That's very important for the survival of the transfer tissue. So here you can see the results. These are some photographs. Initially, we have the two bioreactors. The one at the top is filled with autograft. The one at the bottom is used with a synthetic graft. They're implanted against the periosteum on the rib of the sheep. 9 weeks later, we have the tissue that is formed inside the bioreactor. So we form bone tissue both for the synthetic and the synthetic graft and the autologous graft. So what appears here is pink tissue is the new bone tissue. What appears as black is the hydroxyapatite that hasn't degraded. You can appreciate that the bone tissue grows over the hydroxyapatite. In this particular case, you need a very strong microscope to distinguish which one is the new bone, which one is the old bone. In this particular case, this is the old bone, and the one that grows over it is the new bone. And the reason that I know that this is the old bone is because if I see the cellular, at the cellular level, there are no osteocytes that are embedded within the osteoid. Whereas in the case of the new bone, I can see both the osteoblasts that line the osteoid. I can see the osteocytes that are embedded in the osteoids, where here I can see only empty pores without any living cells. So this was the bone that was generated inside the bioreactors, and this bone can be transferred into the defect after the mandibular defect, after the removal of the space maintainer. So here you can see this is the bone flap. This is the intercostal artery and vein. So the beauty of the model is that you have a single artery and a single vein that provides blood to the tissue. So these two can be microsurgically anastomosed. This is what this white arrow points. So essentially, we transfer living tissue from one side to the other. And after 21 weeks, this is a histological section of the engineer mandible, and this is the contralateral control. So here you have integration of the transfer tissue with the surrounding tissue. What you see here is bigger than the contralateral control, is we have a robust periosteal reaction, so we disrupt the periosteum, so that results in more bone formation. But essentially, the key here is that the transfer bone integrates very well with the surrounding bone, and we're able to heal the defect. So we conducted extensive evaluation of both the engineered tissue and the transfer tissue. Very excitingly, the amount of bone that was formed eventually was comparable to the amount of bone in the contralateral control. Very excitingly, we analyzed the remodeling of the bone. So the bone is a very living tissue. It constantly forms bone and constantly resorbs bone. So we have a balance between bone formation and remodeling. And eventually, the remodeling, the trabecular spacing, is comparable to that of the contralateral control. So this is another success of how biomaterials can be used without any stem cells, without any biologics to regenerate tissues in a process that can be translated faster than in the case of a strategy that would have incorporated stem cells or bioactive molecules. Again, We're very involved in our research with stem cells. We're big believers on the value of stem cells. However, if one can engineer a tissue without a stem cell, this will be great because the regulatory agency will be able to clear the regulation of the medical device much faster than when one uses cell materials. So our laboratory has been very active not only with in vivo bioreactors, but also with in vitro bioreactors. So for the past 10 years, we have investigated how mechanical forces can affect the differentiation of stem cells that are seated in scaffolds that are placed inside flow perfusion bioreactors. What are flow perfusion bioreactors? These are bioreactors where the material is placed and we have flow of media through the pores of the scaffold. So one can incorporate cells within the scaffolds, and one can follow the differentiation of the cells as the result of flow. So over the years, we and others have shown that this mechanical stimulation in the form of shear stress that is generated because of the flow can drive the differentiation of stem cells along different lineages. So in this particular case, we investigated how the fluid mechanics and the osteogenic culture supplements can affect the differentiation of mesenchymal stem cells. So one can take constructs that have no biological use, seed mesenchymal stem cells, culture them, then decellularize the constructs. So what one ends up is very powerful new biomaterial that is essentially the original synthetic material with a coating of extracellular matrix that is very rich in signaling molecules. So essentially we can transform any biomaterial from inert biomaterial to biomaterial that is highly bioactive. And over the years we characterized the extracellular matrix, we characterized how the fluid mechanical environment and the culture period can affect the quality and quantity of the extracellular matrix. However, because of all this expertise over the years with in vitro bioreactors, the last 7-8 years we embarked in collaboration with colleagues at MD Anderson Cancer Center in another direction. How we can use tissue engineering tools to regenerate, not to regenerate, how to generate tumors, tumor models. And we're very much interested, and the entire cancer community is interested in generating tumor models that will be test beds for different drugs, and that will be good predictors of the performance of these drugs in patients. So in 2019, the federal guideline in the United States for the testing of different chemotherapeutic drugs is two-dimensional monolayers. And everybody knows and everybody understands that two-dimensional biology is different from three-dimensional biology in patients. So many times, extensive drug testing using two-dimensional monolayers results in drug screening and clinical trials that eventually fail because the positive results in vitro studies were not good predictors of the performance of the drugs in patients. So what we have been trying to do is to develop models that essentially the tumor cells have the same phenotype as they have the phenotype in cancer patients. So our first effort was reported in PNAS in 2013. Essentially what we took is we took one of our scaffolds, a polyepsilon caprolactone scaffold that was not designed for tumor application, it was designed for bone tissue engineering, and we seeded Ewing sarcoma cells. Ewing sarcoma is the second most common pediatric sarcoma. And what we found was when we take these Ewing sarcoma cells, the Ewing sarcoma cells grow and they form structures very similar to the structures found in patients. That is a big aggregate of the tumor cells. What we did then is we characterized the drug response. And what we found was in 3D, the resistance to different drugs was much higher than the resistance in 2D. So 2D is the black curve, 3D is the green curve. You can forget the middle one, that's an ex vivo model that measures the tumor volume, that clearly under 3D we have more resistance to drugs. Now, all my training is in chemical engineering, so I understand the principles of mass transfer. When I first saw this data, I thought that because in 3D we have diffusional limitations, that is the drug needs to diffuse in larger distances, that is the reason that we have this increased resistance. That may be the case. However, what we found when we analyzed the phenotype of the cells was that in 3D, the phenotype is totally different from the phenotype in 2D. So by simply changing the architecture of the scaffolds, we're able to get the same cells with different phenotype. So for the past 6 years, we're investigating how we can use engineering principles to design new tumor microenvironments. So what is the tumor microenvironment? So we have the sarcoma cells, and the reason we're investigating bone sarcoma is because of all our expertise in the biology of bone, of musculoskeletal tissue. But the same diagram can apply to essentially any tumor. So we have physical elements and biological elements. So some of the physical elements can include an oxygen gradient, can include the presence of interstitial flow, and how interstitial flow and any mechanical stimulation can affect the phenotype of the tumor cells, how the stiffness, how the mechanical environment, whether the tissue is mineralized or not mineralized, whether it's high modulus or low modulus, can affect the phenotype of the sarcoma cells. Also, the presence of any stromal cells, the presence of any fibroblasts, any merostromal cells, any osteoblasts, mesenchymal stem cells, can affect the sarcoma cells. How cells of the immune system, lymphocytes, macrophages, can affect the sarcoma cells, and also, very importantly, how vascular cells and the vascular system can also affect this microenvironment. So for the past 6 years, and we have an increasing effort, we're trying to answer all of these questions. So some of these answers are shown in the next slides. First, we investigated how the flow can affect the phenotype of the unisarcoma cells and the response to different drugs. So we were able to solve essentially a paradox that with some of the drugs that are used in unisarcoma, drugs that are based on IGF-1 receptor, insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor, and the paradox was there were many drugs that work great in cancer patients that did not work in vitro under static conditions. So the contribution to the literature was that when we use flow perfusion bioreactors and we mechanically stimulate the cells, the phenotype of the cell changes and the response to the drug also changes, because bone tumor cells, like bone cells in our skeleton, are subject to mechanical stimulation, and we're able now in vitro using flow perfusion to introduce this mechanical stimulation to a cell population. Also, using 3D printing, we're able to print gradients of pore sizes. So we can introduce now gradients in shear stresses. So we can have flow through the scaffolds that have gradients in the pore size. So we can have gradients in the shear stress. We can have gradients in the phenotype of the tumor cells. So we can create again an environment that better mimics that found in solid tumors. So what was most exciting was a study that we did where we investigated how the co-culture of mesenchymal stem cells. Mesenchymal stem cells are the progenitor cells that form bone tissue and are present in sarcomas together with unisarcoma cells. How the signal between the two cells affect the growth of the tumor. And we investigated different co-culture ratios, that is in the beginning where most of the cells are mesenchymal stem cells, to the end stages of the tumor, that most of the cells are unisarcoma cells. Interestingly, what we found was in the presence of the co-cultures, we have totally different results from the case when we have the homo-cultures. So what is happening is under mechanical stimulation, we activate pathways not only in the cancer cells, but also in the healthy cells. And many times because of the crosstalk between the two populations, we can bypass some of the original cascades that drugs target, and that does not affect the tumor cells. And the only way that we can kill the tumor cells if we target pathways in both populations. So that creates a complexity in the development of new therapeutics that essentially takes into consideration not only the tumor cells, but also this particular macroenvironment. Using advances in biomaterials, this year we reported in Acta Biomaterial another case where we can fabricate materials with different orders of magnitude of mechanical stiffness. So taking advantage of advances in coaxial electrospinning, we can electrospin scaffolds of fibers that essentially have a core out of polycaprolactone, a very hydrophobic, very stiff polymer, and the shell is made of gelatin that is very soft and absorbs a lot of water. So by varying the diameter of the polycaprolactone to the thickness of the cell, we can have different values of the stiffness of the fibers. So we can have scaffolds that essentially have the same architecture, but the fibers have totally different mechanical properties. And we have investigated how osteosarcoma cells, osteosarcoma is the most common pediatric sarcoma, can have on these particular fibers. So what we found was YAP and TAS, these two effectors of the Hippo pathway, this is involved in mechanotransduction, are affected greatly by the mechanical environment. And using advances in confocal microscopy, we were able to characterize the expression and the partition of both YAP and TAS in the cytoplasm and also in the nucleus. So we're able, again, using scaffolds with different mechanical properties, to characterize the YAP and TAS ratio. And this is the results of our studies. So essentially, we showed that first, depending on the architecture, we have YAP nuclear to cytoplasmic ratio, totally different from that in the case of coaxial electrospun fibers with different amount of gelatin. And again, as the amount of gelatin increases, the mechanical properties decrease. So as the stiffness decreases, we have YAP expression increasing and also TAB expression increasing. So the different letters correspond to statistical significance. If two groups have different letters, that means they're statistical significant. If they have the same letter, that means they're statistical insignificant. Now, what's most exciting about this data is that we analyzed the YAP-TAP expression in 37 osteosarcoma patients. And what we found in all cases, the YAP expression, the nuclear to cytoplasmic expression of YAP, was between 1.5 to 2. So clearly, that suggests that the 2D monolayer culture is a very bad predictor of the performance of the phenotype, or predictor of the phenotype of the cells and performance of the response of the drugs to cells. And now, what we're trying to do, knowing the outcome, the eventual outcome of these patients, trying to relate the YAP-TAS expression to the clinical outcome of the patients, that is to relate to the phenotype of the osteosarcoma and the response of the osteosarcoma to different drugs. So what I try to communicate in my presentation is the great value of biomaterials I have in tissue engineering and tumor modeling. So biomaterials can be used in different forms, designs, compositions, and architectures as scaffolds for the three-dimensional culture and transplantation of cells, as conduits for guided tissue growth, as stimulants for a desired cellular response, as carriers for the control release of bioactive molecules, something that I didn't present, that our laboratory is very active in using polymers as non-viral vectors for gene delivery, also polymers as space maintainers as part of a staged regenerative medicine approach, and finally, a new exciting area of how biomaterials can be used as platforms for disease modeling. So I would like to thank again for the great honor to invite me here to present this lecture. I would like to thank all the collaborators that provided inspiration for our work, NIH and the Department of Defense for providing most of the funding for our work, but most importantly, the people who did the work. Thank you very much.